Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, latest edition, the latest chapter in what goes on Planet Porky. Yes, it's life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this fine day?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Mike. Just getting on with it, cracking on.
Yes.
Not much of a Christmas to look forward to, but something of a Christmas, which, you know, I think quite recently we've been worrying, haven't we, that there wouldn't be anything at all. So.
Well, we still don't know whether there might be at the last minute, you know. I mean, you're absolutely right, but it's put a terrible damper on it again, I agree. I normally really sort of love the build-up to Christmas, you know, the sort of 2 or 3 weeks before when the parties have started and everybody's feeling Christmassy. And I've noticed this year, by the way, that even street lighting in town seems to have been massively scaled down. I don't know if you've noticed, but certainly near where I live, places like Epsom, they used to string them across the road, you know, from side to side. And now there's just like a little sort of bit of a decoration on the top of the lamppost type thing.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think maybe we touched on the fact that nocturnal wildlife is very disturbed by all this street lighting that stays alight all night long. Because, yeah, they come out at night and they don't know whether it's nighttime or not.
Yeah, well,
when all the lighting is going on. And also it costs a lot of money. We're polluting the atmosphere. It's not very eco, is it, to keep electric lights burning all through the night.
Oh,
so,
no.
I'm kind of over that, really.
Yeah, okay. I don't mind that. I mean, obviously, I want to look after little animals that get startled by bright lights and all that, but it still brings a festive feeling to a town when you
put
all those lights all over the place. Anyway, there we are. Right-ho. Now, Ms. Jones, I've got tooth problems again. I've got to get off and see another dentist in Harley Street, you know? And people mock me and say, oh, you know, Porky, boasting about your wealth again. Well, I haven't got any wealth, really. All I've got is what I have, which everybody else has, and I just try to get on with life. But the reason I've gone to Harley Street is that I had the last filling in my mouth that was black got cracked, a few months ago. And I'd had all the others either replaced by crowns or new fillings that were white or implanted teeth. I've spent an awful lot of money on my mouth over the years. So I go and see my dentist, who's a great guy, by the way. I've had him for now 25 years or a bit longer. And he's never let me down on anything. He's absolutely, you know, he's put in implants and crowns and all that. And so I had a look at it. Yes, it's got to come out. Yes, we'll put a crown on that. That should be fine. So it was probably the sixth crown he'd done for me. And after a few weeks, I thought, this doesn't feel right. You know, I can still, you know, that moment when you get like a blackberry seed on top of that tooth and you bite on it, you know, it gives you that electric shock type movement, you know, that was happening. And I thought, this isn't right. So I went back to see him. He said, look, sometimes the ligaments, I didn't know there were ligaments in teeth, but apparently there are, the ligaments get damaged. It takes a few weeks for them to repair. Just stick with it. Anyway, another month went by. No, same problem. So I went to see him again. So he chiselled a bit of stuff around the tooth, you know, and I said, you know, are you sure it's the right crown? You know, oh, yes, of course it is. You know, crowns are unique to each individual's measurements and all that kind of stuff. And then another month went by and still no joy. It was still painful. So he said, you're going to have root canal surgery. He said, I can do it here, but I'd prefer to send you to a specialist unit where they've got even more sophisticated equipment. So I go off to Harley Street, you know, the home of world famous home of medicine. And over a period of about an hour and a half, when I had to wear headphones and listen to music and all that kind of stuff, they drill down through the crown and then take all the nerves out of your gut.
Oh, God, no, this is horrible.
Yeah, they don't take the crown off and then work on it. They drill through, you know, needles which are as thin as hairs, apparently.
No, I have to go and lie down.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this is all too much.
Yeah, and then the nerves are supposed to be taken out and then you're supposed to be, you know, like pain-free. Anyway, exactly the same thing happened. There'd been no change in it whatsoever. So I've had to go back again to my original dentist who referred me to the Harley Street specialist, and today I'm back off to Harley Street to see if I can resolve it before Christmas, because you don't want to be eating your, you know, Christmas pudding worried that a bit of plum will suddenly give you electric shock in your mouth, you know?
I suppose the answer is to stop eating.
No, the answer is eventually I'll have to have it all taken out, and, you know, by that time I'll have spent about £3,000 on it. But I said to my original dentist, I said, look, hang on, I thought root canal surgery was about taking the nerves out of your gum so you can't feel pain. He said, yeah, but once again, I'm afraid it's that ligament problem that you'll always have, no matter whether you've got nerves in it or not. And I said,
Are you sure that you have ligaments in your teeth?
Absolutely. That's what the doc told me. And I said,
ligaments are joints. They're to do with joints, aren't they?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, he definitely said ligaments. And I said, look, doc, if you'd have told me all this, I might have opted to have it taken out in the first place. And he said, no, it's a perfectly healthy tooth and there shouldn't be any reason why the crown doesn't make it. The second guy, the specialist guy, told me what was left of the tooth underneath the crown was cracked. And I said, well, why didn't someone tell me that? He said, well, it doesn't really matter because the crown holds it together, but you may get infection in it because of the crack. I said, why wasn't I told this, you know, before all this started anyway?
Because they want your money. Well, you could make a whole series about this called The Crown.
The Crown. Thank you very much, Miss Jones. You haven't lost your touch, have you? I understand your daughter's had a bit of dental problem, a dental problem.
Oh, poor Mia. Mia's my beautiful eldest daughter. And when she was 8 years old, she came over the handlebars of a bike going downhill. She was having tea at a friend's house and the mother kind of let them out going, you know, hurtling down a hill on bikes. Mm. And she lost all her front teeth and they were the new ones that had just come through. So it was tragic. And she had to have extensive dental work over all the years and have,
it's
you know.
A terrible thing for a little 8 year old, isn't it?
Yeah, it really was. Because,
she thinks, oh, I'm not going to be pretty and my mouth's all damaged and all that. It'd be horrible.
Exactly. Yeah, she really went through it.
Yeah.
Recently, she had all the caps redone in the front of her mouth. Hmm. And when I saw her a few weeks ago, I said, Mia, Your front teeth look black, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, God, not you as well. People keep saying this to me. I think there's something wrong with my new caps. So I said, look, you've got to go back to Catherine, who is our family dentist, and get her to have a look at them.
Yeah.
So she rang me and said, Catherine said the minute I walked into the surgery, oh, God, what's happened to your teeth?
Mm.
And it's something to do.
She's a dentist after all, yeah.
Exactly. And she's the one who made them. So. Yeah. She said in a very rare set of circumstances, the cement that they use to fix the new caps in oxidizes and it turns black underneath the enamel, fake enamel that they put in.
Yeah.
So she's now got to have the whole lot done again, which she's absolutely devastated by. It cost her £3,500.
Good God, that's awful. And the worst thing about all this is that there's no NHS dentists anymore. When they set up the NHS, everything was free at the point of delivery, and that included dentistry. I remember when I was a little kid, my mum would take me and my two sisters, when we were about 5, 6 and 7, to Mr. Smith, the local dentist in Hoole in Chester, and he did it all, and then we left. Nobody ever paid any money or bills. It was just given as a right of living in the United Kingdom that you got your teeth done.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, because people expect all this stuff to be free, glasses as well. But the NHS was never designed to service the millions and millions of people that live in our country today. So it has to wind down.
Yeah, no, and, I totally agree.
You know, you used to be able to go and get a boil sucked out at your GPs, for example. Yeah, not literally sucked out.
Yeah,
but now that's considered a cosmetic procedure. So you now have to go and find somebody privately, a dermatologist, to do things like that. So they are winding it down bit by bit.
Yes,
I think.
Yes. No, I tell you, it needs a wholesale reform. I totally agree. Anyway, distressing subjects. Let's do something a bit more lively as we're going towards Christmas. Now, you told me some time ago, I don't know if this is lively, but it's certainly concerning, that there'd always been a question mark over the sort of groupies that all the big supergroups attracted during their years. And there's a new book coming out on Led Zeppelin. And, you know, I'm only repeating what I read in the serialisation of the book, that there are allegations that girls as young as 14 and armies of them used to follow Led Zeppelin around America. And some mothers were so desperate to get their children into the sort of, you know, the limelight, they would drive them hundreds of miles to a Led Zeppelin hotel, even though the daughter was 14 years of age, and wait for them for days outside the hotel until they'd, you know, been used by the band, allegedly, and then, you know, thrown out the hotel bedroom and all. It's a terrible story.
Yeah, it's unthinkable, isn't it? But
yeah.
I mean, this is all about money. This is like those mothers who sold their kids to the Hollywood casting couch. It's absolutely no different.
Yeah.
They saw a life of glamour and wealth, and if they could only get their child to somehow marry one of these rock stars and, you know, live
yes.
that life, which the mother, by default, would then be able to enjoy herself.
Mm.
It's absolutely shocking.
Yeah.
This is Bob Spitz's new book.
Oh, yeah.
Called Led Zeppelin, the biography. Hmm. It's actually been called out within the industry for quite a few inaccuracies.
Right.
I've not read it myself yet, but I will do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's another example of rock's Me Too moment returns.
Sure.
We had the stories recently about Bob Dylan, didn't we?
Yes.
Abusing a 12-year-old in 1965.
Hmm.
That lady is now 68. Her whole life has been ruined by the alleged experience, which
yeah.
will come to court in America quite soon.
Mm.
I kind of sense that it might be true, you know, because Bob Dylan had a fling with Dana Gillespie when she was 15.
Mm.
Dana Gillespie has written herself that she had sex with David Bowie, Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin, Keith Moon, Mick Jagger, Michael Caine, Sean Connery.
She got around a bit, didn't she?
She got around, but she was 15 years old.
Mm.
And who was meant to be looking after her?
Yeah.
Obviously, the parents.
Yeah, well.
So, you know, there's more of this to come. And I don't think they're going to get away with it. I think what happened with Harvey Weinstein and the whole Hollywood scandal, it is taking its time in rock and roll, but it is breaking.
Yeah, well, as I say, he must be very confident to have published that book, and everything that we've spoken about is already in the public domain because it was serialised in the Daily Mail, a paper you and I both read, you know. But I don't know. I've seen no reaction from the group, no feedback, anything like that. Apparently, the guy who was in charge of all this is a bloke called Richard Cole, who, quite coincidentally, died the week the book came out, a couple of weeks ago, and he was the tour manager for the Led Zeppelin, and he was worse than the musicians themselves. Apparently, it was Banaclian, the sort of orgies and parties this guy used to organise.
Or Bacchanalian, even.
Bacchanalian, thank you.
You know what I thought when Richard Cole died? Because there were huge outpourings of grief and remembrances
yep.
all over social media about this. What a wonderful guy he was. And I thought, oh, okay, he's died the week the book comes out.
Hmm.
Is that a coincidence?
Well, I mean, I'm sure they didn't time his death for when the book came out. I think it's an amazing coincidence. I mean, you're not trying to suggest he might have killed himself, are you?
Well, it begs the question.
I suppose so.
Did he suddenly realise his time was up?
Yeah, well, I didn't read what he died of, to be honest, but you don't often in obituaries, you know. Just...
Yeah, but whatever they say,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
isn't necessarily the case.
Well, honestly, it's an...
It's all that I'm saying.
Interesting theory. Listen, talking about rock stars, let's talk on a much, much brighter and upper level. I see Roger Taylor, the drummer from Queen, not the Roger Taylor in Duran Duran. Well, there is a Roger Taylor in Duran Duran, isn't there?
There's a Roger Taylor everywhere, isn't
yeah, there?
Yeah, there, really?
There is. There is. You're absolutely right. I see that he moans now because when he sort of, you know, obviously Queen's gone a long time ago, when he meets people now at receptions, dues, or just meets them socially, they all stare in shock at him when he revealed that he sung on every Queen song. And they said, but you're the drummer. We didn't know that you sung. He said, of course I sung. I sung on every Queen track. And what's more, I co-wrote three of the number one hits. And he feels, you know, wounded and hurt that he doesn't get the praise and the accord he should get for being a much bigger part of the group than just the drummer.
Oh, he should shut up moaning. He's been moaning for years. You know, anyone who doesn't know that Roger Taylor sings, you've only got to watch one of their videos to see
yeah.
his face up against the microphone next to his drum kit singing away. He is the falsetto in the group's sound.
Yeah.
So, you know, in Bohemian Rhapsody, he's the one singing the very high Mamma Mia, Mamma Mias.
Oh, really?
I bet you can't quote me the number ones that he wrote for Queen.
I think I can, actually, because...
Oh, you've probably got them written down.
I have got them written down. Here we go. Dad of Five, Roger, hailed as one of the best drummers in the world, has written or co-written three UK number ones. These Are the Days of Our Lives, Innuendo, and Under Pressure.
Yeah, OK. Under Pressure, of course, was their hit that they had with David Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
And they were a bit disgruntled because they had to argue the toss with David Bowie. That song came about from a jamming session in their studio, Mountain Studios in Switzerland. Yeah. He famously wrote, and I can't see why they haven't quoted this, Radio Gaga.
Yeah, I thought that as well. When I read that, because I remember at the time, obviously, I was very attracted to it because it mentioned radio, and I think I was still working in newspapers at the time on the Daily Express. But nevertheless, it was a media-type-driven song, you know.
And also, Lady Gaga took her name from that song.
Did she?
She was a massive Queen fan.
Ah, I didn't know that, yeah.
Yeah, she did. And he also wrote A Kind of Magic. It's A Kind of Magic, was their massive sort of 86 hit.
Yeah.
I think what most people don't know is that Roger Taylor wrote I'm in Love with My Car, a track you won't ever have heard of.
No, I haven't.
It's important because it's the B-side of Bohemian Rhapsody. So before Queen had decided to equalise the payment of royalties to all the members of the band, whoever wrote the song got the royalties.
Yes.
So whoever wrote the B-side got equal royalties to the guy who composed the A-side.
Right.
Which obviously Freddie Mercury wrote Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes.
And Roger got equal royalties because he wrote this obscure song, I'm in Love with My Car. Have a listen to it. I think you might give it a swerve.
How very odd indeed. Listen, as we're moving towards Christmas, I read that the Volavant is coming back, Miss Jones.
Are you a
Volavant fan
now? I can't see the point of them. A whole load of crumbly paper-tasting pastry with some smelly prawns in the middle. You can't talk to anybody while you're eating one because you spray them with bits of pastry.
Hmm.
I think they're disgusting.
Well, I think eaten in the right sort of circumstances, they're really nice. I love the soft
paper. On your own, inside a closed cupboard.
Well, no, not really. But, you know, if you're with sort of friends, so to speak, rather than at a reception or something like that, if they were served as a nibbler taster before dinner or something like this, while you're having a glass of wine or something like that, I think that's perfectly fine. I love the soft pastry, and I love it when they fill it with something like salmon or something like that.
But then have you ever tried talking to somebody at a reception who's just eaten salmon or prawns or some kind of fish? So not only are you being sprayed with bits of pastry, but this horrible stench of fish.
Yeah, well,
it's disgusting.
Yeah, okay. All right, maybe you turn me off them. What about...
No, Volavant is something you've got to eat with a knife and fork on a plate.
Yeah.
So that defeats the object.
Yeah, no, I don't mind taking little things off a plate if they're like prawn toast or something like that, you know what I mean? Which don't fall apart in your hands or something like that. But like you, I'm very, very wary of eating in front of anybody else at any time, to be honest. And I certainly never take the finger food at these parties where some people pick three off the plate and stuff them in their mouth as they're talking to you, you know, like a pig, honest to God. And I can't stand that.
No, it's gross. It is horrible.
Yeah, when anybody ever does that, I just walk away. I think, you know, how ignorant you are to be doing that in front of me when I'm trying to talk to you.
One thing you cannot do, I don't think any human being can do this, is speak and eat at the same time.
I totally agree.
We were brought up to behave in this way, that you don't speak with your mouth full.
I totally agree.
But the whole thing about cocktail parties is standing around talking to people.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't also involve eating.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I worked for an editor once, and I used to run the paper on a Sunday, so I'd ring him sometimes. And this guy, and I'm not going to embarrass him by saying who it is, but he would have the phone on the table at home where he was having his Sunday roast lunch. And he was so arrogant that if anybody rang, he just hit the speaker button. And then he would not stop eating. He would talk for maybe 5 or 6 minutes, but continuing to eat, continuing to shovel roast beef and potatoes into his mouth while talking to you. It was disgusting. And I used to just cut the phone off. I just used to cut it off. And then remarkably, a few minutes later, he'd say, oh, we seem to have lost the line there. He never, honest to God, he never cottoned on to the idea that I found his eating habits so disgusting and that he couldn't even stop eating for 3 or 4 minutes while I discussed with him what we were going to put on page three, you know. Honestly, it used to absolutely revolt me.
And the other thing, of course, is it's really horribly rude to his wife and whoever else is sitting at the table eating with him.
Exactly. Absolutely. But such an act of arrogance, you know, and honestly, it really just turned me off completely. But anyway, there we are, talking about things which are coming back, not just the Volavant, Baileys cream. Now,
that's horrible.
I love a Baileys.
No, no, no. The only that's the coffee one, isn't it? Taste of coffee.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's a liqueur.
I can't have anything that tastes of coffee.
Well, Bailey's liqueur doesn't really taste like coffee to me. It tastes just sort of like Bailey's. But the
which is what exactly?
Well, I don't know.
It's not coffee.
Well, I don't know, some kind of liqueur. But no, the danger for me with Bailey's is that it doesn't even taste alcoholic, and you can drink a whole bottle of it yourself and then collapse. You know what I mean? That's the thing. When I was much younger than I am now, probably in my early 20s, I suddenly got a liking. In fact, I adored Harvey Wallbangers. Okay,
In a Harvey Wallbanger? I've forgotten.
A Harvey Wallbanger is orange vodka and what's the magic ingredient? It's not Grenadier or something like that. I don't know.
Grenadine.
That's it. Well done. Yeah, Grenadine.
Grenadier.
Yeah, Grenadier. Yeah.
It's got a whole country in it. Swallow that.
Probably comes from Granada. And so it was one summer. I remember distinctly. I remember the girlfriend I was with at the time, and I thought, you know, I'm going to look really cool here. I'm going to start drinking Harvey Wallbangers. Okay. And I looked up the origin of a Harvey Wallbanger, and it was in fact a bloke in Chicago called Harvey, who invented the drink and ended up always banging his head against the wall, you know, because he had so many of them. That's why it's called the Harvey Wallbanger. But the problem was you could drink six and still not feel even slightly intoxicated. I don't know why, because there was a big slug of vodka in it and the grenadine. But I think the orange juice just covered everything up. It was like drinking fresh orange, you know, like orange juice. Very dangerous. What's your favourite cocktail then?
Cocktail? I've always been a bit wary of cocktails, mostly because they hit you by stealth.
I was about to say,
as you just said,
they can be lethal. Yeah,
and lots of them are very sugary. I don't really like the combination.
Yes.
I suppose I quite like. Let's think.
White Russian.
The one that's got. What is it? The the red stuff. It's completely gone out of my head. What was the one they used to advertise Leonard Rossiter and Joan Collins on?
Vermouth.
No.
Vermouth, Cinzano.
Was that Campari? Campari is the one I love.
Campari, okay. Yeah.
So no, anything with, I think there's a Negroni that has Campari in it.
Right, okay.
Which is, I like that because it's slightly bitter. It's not
it is.
Too sweet.
You're right. Campari is for days out at the Epsom Derby. You know, when you've got a tent there or a box there and somebody brings in a huge bowl of Campari and ice, and it's that's what it reminds me of. Epsom Downs on Derby Day. But it is very, very nice, I agree.
I tell you what you can't beat, though, is a basic gin and tonic with, you know, a very nice flavoured gin, lots of ice, some lemon or a slice of orange or something. We've had our afternoons on
definitely.
A few G&Ts, haven't we?
Oh, definitely, Miss Jones. No doubt about it. You know, I've seen you get stuck into the large G&Ts with gusto. and funny enough, I've gone more to vodka lately because I find the gin a little, what is it? Do you know, by the way, you can be addicted to tonic. Tonic water's got something called quinine in it, hasn't it?
And that's why it was invented. It was during the Happy Valley set in East Africa.
Really?
At the turn of the century when they had no treatment for malaria.
And that's a good
and
point.
And quinine is a good treatment for malaria, or was at that time.
Yeah.
So they invented this mixer to go with their gin, which was a deterrent to the mosquitoes.
Well, brilliant news. And then it caught on, of course, and then people have been drinking it ever since. You're absolutely right. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, there's only one podcast left after this before Christmas, so I hope that you are suitably prepared for the festivities and all the challenges it's going to bring us this year.
Yes, well, this Christmas is unusual because my son is in panto.
Yes,
he is.
Oh, yes.
And he only gets one day off from the performances. So our family Christmas is one day this year, and we're making the most of the one day. I'm also writing a book, and my deadline is hurtling towards me.
Right.
And I haven't got enough time to take too many days off over Christmas.
Right.
So we're just focusing on the 25th, and that'll be it this year.
And just get on with it. But you've also got a carol service at St. Bride's, haven't you?
Yes, we do have two carol services on the 22nd,
yeah.
Which everyone is welcome. Fleet Street Carols, one at 12 noon,
yeah.
Where Nick Ferrari will be giving the reading that lunchtime.
Oh, lovely.
And then I'll be giving the same reading at the 5 o'clock service.
Yeah.
Same service, different readers.
Yeah, okay. I love a carol service. When I was a kid, I went to the King's School, Chester, and for the carol service, it was always held inside Chester Cathedral, because before the school moved to its current site on a place called the Wrexham Road, which is the road to Wrexham out of Chester, the school was based inside the cathedral. And to this day, the classes for the 12 and 13-year-olds are called the cloisters at the new site, because they were actually held in the cloisters in Chester Cathedral, you know. The actual, you know, design of the cloisters, like a shell-type thing where the monks used to inhabit. So there's lots of history between the King's School Chester and Chester Cathedral, and I used to love the carol service there. All the parents used to come. It was a really great end to the school term, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a shame that you can't come to Fleet Street Carols that day.
Yeah,
because,
I'm awfully sorry. Yeah, because
yeah, you know, another year though.
Yes, another year, definitely. Now then, Miss Jones, how bright do you think I am?
Oh, exceedingly bright, beyond all expectation.
Excellent. Well done. Thank you. Because I picked up on a story this week. Rocket scientists, they're no more intelligent than the rest of us. And he goes on to say that the discovery that aerospace engineers and neurosurgeons, that's brain surgeons, right? You always talk about rocket science or brain surgery. They have similar levels of intelligence to everyone else. And their tasks that they perform should not have been put on a pedestal. So this report, I don't know who's made it, I'll find out in a minute, in the BMJ, British Medical Journal, it says that rocket scientists and brain surgeons shouldn't be held in awe and elevated as super intelligent above the rest of us. Does that mean that any one of us then could say, oh, well, I tell you what, I didn't really want to be a writer. I didn't really want to be an accountant. I think I will now actually be a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon.
Obviously not, because they go through rigorous training and many years of it.
Yeah.
I actually know a brain surgeon. He's the,
oh, really?
The young son of a very dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he is a qualified brain surgeon, and he's doing that work. And I always am in such awe of him.
Yeah.
But I've known him since he was a little boy.
Right.
And he's such a lovely person.
Yeah.
He just happens to have chosen a profession in which he has been so highly trained.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that any of us would have the aptitude for that kind of training.
Yeah.
Not everybody is cut out to do that work.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The reason this story struck me was because I once wrote a book called Rooney Tunes, okay? And it came up again this week. It always does. Somebody's wandering through a secondhand bookshop, which we all like to do, don't we? And they come across a copy of Rooney Tunes by Mike Parry. And I wrote it just before the 2006 World Cup in Germany, I think. Yeah, 2006 in Germany. And it would have sold millions if England had won, but they didn't. So it didn't quite sell millions. But the point of my story is, the reason I'm saying this is, I got hold of a Cambridge professor who eventually admitted that Wayne Rooney's brain is probably as efficient and as good as Einstein's. Because I said to the professor, look what a footballer has to think about in one tenth of a second. So I positioned Rooney in the penalty area, and the winger's gone down the wing, he's whipped the ball over. Rooney's then got a tenth of a second to work out the flight of the ball, the speed of the ball, the speed of the wind affecting the ball, the angle the ball's coming in at, the angle at which he's got to turn his body to meet it, the part of his body that's got to engage with the ball, how much force and velocity needs to be put into that part of his body to strike the ball, and then he's got to direct the ball at a completely different angle to the one it's coming at him from. And the professor looked at all this and then said, yes, you've got a really good point there. Do you remember Wayne Rooney scoring a fantastic overhead kick? I think it was against Manchester City. He threw himself up in the air and it was a bicycle kick and ball rocketed into the top of the net. You know, when Rooney does that, he has literally one-tenth of a second to work out an amazingly complicated equation.
Yes, but it's all academic because he is not making those specific calculations. Those are all instinctive, and his brain is doing that regardless of his own input.
Of course it is, but that's what I'm saying. His brain must be working on overdrive or working very, very fast to calculate all that and still get it right at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think it's all relative because all of our brains are engaged in whatever we do for a living or, you know, whatever we do for a pastime. Yeah. All of our brains are making those overriding decisions on our behalf without us actively thinking about it and focusing on it. It's a bit like driving a car. Look at the number of acts and different procedures we go through when we're driving a car. There are all kinds of things involved. Or say you're a disc jockey and you're focusing on the next record coming up, by how many seconds you've got left of this one, when you're going to bring the guest in, which fader you need to push up, which one comes down, all of that. It all becomes instinctive. You don't actually think through the process. Yeah. You're doing it instinctively. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, and I think you're probably right. Of course, the dreaded working from home, because you just mentioned the fact that you've got to, you know, meet a deadline book. So you are working from home, I assume, or certainly you're
not. I always work from home, apart from when you and I are in a studio.
Yes, well, exactly. Absolutely. So so I dread the working from home. I think it cripples the economy again and it robs people of their initiative. I went on to a TV show this week and I put that point of view forward. And I got howled down by everybody, it's rubbish, it's a better lifestyle for people and all that. But I don't get much support for the, trying to beat the drum for the economy by getting people out and about. And I feel disconsolate about it because, to me, working from home robs you of the, I mean, I know you do it because you have to do it and it's your job. But I do think people should get back into the sort of offices you and I used to work in to improve their own lives.
The workplace is a place where ideas and communications flourish. And in an ideal world, which we're not living in at the moment, it is the best kind of working environment.
Yes.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yes.
At the moment, we're dealing with Omicron. There is, I'm told, something even worse on its way, which we all need to be very careful about. Mm. We haven't seen the worst of it yet, by no stretch of the imagination.
Golly, that's
January and February, I think, are going to be very challenging for us all. And there does seem to be something more menacing on the horizon.
Really?
So I think for now, we all just need to calm down, do as we're told.
Calm down.
Yeah, calm down.
Yeah.
Just get on with things the best we can and make the best of it.
Yeah.
And look after ourselves, wear our masks, get our boosters, do all that. You know, absolutely. It's not rocket science.
Absolutely. Listen, there's a lot of rock star talk in today's podcast. That's because a lot's happening with rock stars. And one of them has also gone. Sorry, we have to dwell on rock stars who died, but that's when they come to prominence after years of being forgotten about. But Mike Nesmith of the Monkees has died, and it was all quite sudden, really. I think he was in kind of his late 60s, 67, 68, something like that. He was the only member of the Monkees who really had even an ounce of musical talent, wasn't he?
No, I don't think so. Peter Tork was also a gifted musician.
Oh, was he?
He was a folk guitarist.
Yeah.
I think, they were... What happened with the Monkees? They were sort of the prefab four, weren't they? They were assembled by audition.
Audition,
in 1965.
Yes.
Davy Jones had been the Artful Dodger on Broadway.
Yes, that's right.
And Peter Tork was, as I said, a folk guitarist. Mickey Dolenz was a working actor.
Yeah.
And Nesmith, too, was a musician. And so there was this sort of myth that they didn't actually play their instruments and they weren't proper musicians. Mm. But I think that that was propaganda put around at the time.
Mm. Well,
Neil Diamond.
Funny enough, sorry, you're going to say Neil Diamond. I interrupted you, but you're right. By the way, Mike Nesmith was the 78. I've just checked that out.
He was. No, Neil Diamond, I was about to say, wrote their greatest hit, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I'm a believer. And I think that was another thing. You know, people said, they don't write their own songs like the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they've got to get other people to write them. It just happened that they made a cover version of one of Neil Diamond's best songs.
Which one was that?
I'm a Believer.
I didn't know he'd done it before. I thought he'd written it for them. No, but he'd already recorded it, had he?
Oh, maybe he'd written it and hadn't recorded it, but he certainly performs it. Yeah.
Somebody else wrote their first hit, which was Last Train to Clarksville. Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. I have made a reservation. I thought that excuse me, the half dozen hits they had were nice little pop songs, okay? But I do remember at school, I was probably about 11 or something like that, and all of a sudden, you know, all the Beatles fans suddenly started turning to being Monkees fans. And I was outraged. You know, I used to go around the school threatening to beat people up if they turned from the Beatles to the Monkees, because I said, the Monkees, I said, they're just a flash in the pan. You know, they don't come from Liverpool and all this kind of stuff. In fact, the original story is that Four Zany Lads Wanted, I think, was the advert in Variety or something like that, you know, to form a group. But ostensibly, it was to put together a TV show. Which came out once a week and was shown at about 5:15 on a Saturday night in this country. But the figures were so low, the show was never recommissioned, and that's why the Monkees split up, because it was, in essence, a TV show that had flopped, and therefore there was no point in it.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of that over the years. I mean, nobody sits around going, One Direction aren't a proper band, or weren't,
no.
because they were put together on a TV show. You know, the rules have changed, haven't they, really?
Yes.
In those days, there was a lot of comparison to the Beatles.
And, yes.
I'm quite shocked to hear, Mr. Parry, that you would go around beating people up,
yes,
not liking the Beatles.
Yeah, threatened to beat them up, definitely. You know, you're not changing to the Monkees. How dare you, and all that. David Jones, of course, was the only English member, and he was so tiny that before he became a stage actor, he was a jockey. He was only about 4'11" or something like that. But anyway, cute little guy, nevertheless. Did you read that terrible story, Miss Jones, about a lady called Julie Simpson, who was ejected from a social club in Middlesbrough, of all places, although I've been to Middlesbrough a few times, so I can believe it, but she was ejected from a social club because it was men's darts night and she's a woman. I mean, are we back in the caveman era?
I thought this kind of thing was illegal these days.
So did I.
So what happened there?
I don't know. Apparently, if it's like, you know, a working men's club or something like that, you can make your own rules, apparently, and it just so happened on that night. But, I mean, isn't that a terrible reflection of the way some people in our society still think? Huh?
Well, it reminds me of Elvino's in the old days. You know, yeah, we female journalists couldn't go into Elvino if we were not being brought in by a male journalist, which is ridiculous.
And didn't you have to wear trousers as well or something?
Oh, we all dressed up as blokes one time to try and get in there. But when I look back on that, I think, was I mad?
Mm.
Why did I want to go to a place that didn't want me there in the first place?
Well, to challenge the, you know, stupid rule and authority. I don't blame that at all.
I'd rather find somewhere else.
Well, exactly, where you felt welcome. No, I totally agree with that. Now then, Lewis Hamilton has been knighted, right? I mean, he was knighted some time ago, but he actually got his gong this week. And that came just a few days after he was beaten to the world championship for and it would have been his eighth title by young Max Verstappen. And again, I was invited onto a radio show this time to give my opinion on it. And in my opinion, he was absolutely robbed. Lewis Hamilton was robbed. But the point I was going to make to you was there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of public sympathy for Lewis Hamilton. If that had been any other English sportsman who had been beaten in a very dodgy decision, literally on the line of the last race by a young Dutchman, we'd have been in uproar. But for some unknown reason, Lewis Hamilton can't seem to evoke great public sympathy in this country. And it could be because he lives in Monaco. I don't know.
The public has never really taken him to their hearts, have they?
No.
I think part of it is that he's a tax exile, so he doesn't contribute to the public purse.
Yeah, but the Rolling Stones, for goodness sake, went off to France for 10 years, didn't they?
Well, a couple of years, They, in fact, none of them is domiciled in the UK anymore, apart from Ronnie Wood, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Or maybe Bill Wyman, but he's not a proper Rolling Stone anymore, is he?
No, he's not, no.
Mick Jagger lives most of the time in France.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Richards is based in upstate New York.
Right.
This was all to do with the draconian tax laws at the time, which I think it took some more than 90% in the pound of everything they earned. So,
well,
you know, why not?
Do you remember George Harrison's song, Tax Man?
Yep.
Tax Man, 19 for you and one for me. They were paying 19 shillings in the pound in tax God, that doesn't half age us, doesn't it? Talking about counselling.
I think Lewis Hamilton, he's quite mouthy about things that go on in the UK.
And yes, he is.
People tend to turn around and go, well, what's it to you? You know, you don't even live here anyway. He doesn't feel like a proper folk hero of our times.
Well,
I do think he was robbed. Yeah. I do think it was a bad decision. I suspect that it was to do with television ratings, injecting a bit of controversy, is that the word, into proceedings?
Definitely. Netflix are making a programme about Formula One, and that was the last programme. And there's been a lot of insinuations that the guy called Michael somebody or other, Michael Marty, I think his name is, who's race controller, had somehow been influenced by the fact that they wanted a very dramatic end, you know what I mean? And so he kind of made up the rules as he went along. But on Lewis Hamilton, I feel a bit sorry for Lewis Hamilton. I think he's a great guy. Excuse me, he could be our greatest ever sportsman, and public recognition doesn't seem to get him. He is mouthy. He's been a very, very strong supporter of Black Lives Matter, and, you know, that's something that other people have got involved in, and very, very varying views on Black Lives Matter and the movement and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, Lewis Hamilton's absolutely entitled to throw his support behind movements which he believes in. I just don't know. He dresses extremely strangely. Have you ever seen the pictures of him when he's at a track in practice 2 or 3 days before an event? I mean, I don't just mean that he is, well-dressed or expensively dressed. He dresses like he hangs curtains on himself and all sorts of things.
It's a bit like Harry Styles wearing dresses and earrings and makeup, isn't it? Do we care, really? No.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that Formula One is even a sport, to be honest with you. My father used to say this. He objected vociferously to these two things being classed as sport, Formula One and ice dancing. He could never get Torval and Dean either.
Yeah. I got Torval and Dean for their excellence. I was never a great fan of ice skating, but I thought, God, they're so good that they did it. But I know what you mean. I know you don't.
But is it a sport? That's the question.
I tell you. And again, motor racing, is it a sport? I don't. Sports usually two men pitched against each other in a boxing ring or across a tennis net, isn't it? Talking about, you just said Harry Styles dressing in women's clothes and that kind of stuff. What about this shocking development? Charlotte Griffiths is a journalist, works for the Mail Group, who went into, I'm sure you've seen this, she went into a women's changing room in a shop, I can't remember which one it was, and 2 6-foot-tall men who looked just like men were sharing the same changing room after telling the lady who was in charge of that clothes department that they'd identified their gender as female.
Yeah, it's gone mad. It has actually gone mad. The Mail did another story. They showed a big, strapping, bearded male journalist outside Harrods clutching a bunch of lingerie that he'd just tried on in the ladies' changing rooms in Harrods.
Yes.
Are we not thinking straight? It's fairly obvious to me that if somebody wants to identify as something other than male or female, that there needs to be a third facility, another changing room where such people, good on them, can go in and all get changed and undressed together.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's just common sense, isn't it? Why embarrass, threaten and humiliate a person of one gender by making them mix with the other? This all started, by the way, with mixed wards in hospitals, you know.
Yes, I know that. But I we're all sort of old enough and ugly enough to look after ourselves.
Yes.
If I go into a changing room and there's a couple of blokes in there messing around, I'm just going to walk straight back out. I'm not putting up with that. But I don't want to have my daughters have to go through that humiliation.
Yeah.
I don't want all vulnerable young women or young girls, teenagers, to have to put up with this. Why should they?
Well, yes, but you see, you just said that, oh, if I went in there were men in there. But supposing you were already getting changed and somebody else came in, you know, who was a man, then you can't run because you're half unclothed. It's really ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, and in lots of these changing rooms, it's sort of free for all. So you don't have little compartments, little cubicles, which have got curtains on them or anything.
No.
You're all standing there in the midst of this kind of, you know, hall of mirrors.
Yes.
Flashing your cellulite and all this. Really, I don't want to get my kit off in front of a load of strange blokes.
Of course not. I totally agree. And by the way, I work for an organisation which has brand new studios and all that, and they've got unisex loos, and I absolutely hate it. I can't, I mean, not just because I feel so embarrassed, but I feel so embarrassed for the poor women who are standing there trying to put their makeup on in front of a mirror, and blokes are walking in and out of the cubicles behind them. It's just disgusting, you know?
And also, let's face it, I don't want to be too graphic, but men are not as generally as clean and tidy, let's say, as ladies in a public toilet facility.
Well,
so, you know, I'm sure that you are, but most are not.
I know exactly what you mean, that, you know, men can, you know, certainly be not as specific about personal hygiene sometimes as women. I accept all that, but I'm not. I never leave a bathroom unless it's in the pristine condition it was in when I walked in. Honestly, there's no problem on that. But I do accept what you're saying. Also, you know, men are bigger and beefier, and you know, it's
and smellier. Yes, they are
exactly. And the
life. My friend Julie from school,
yeah.
We were at school together from when we were 11.
Yeah.
She manages a pub in Salisbury.
Right.
And they have transvestite nights.
Right.
When she is required to share the ladies' bathroom with a bunch of enormous men dressed as women.
Golly.
And she can't stand it. She actually goes home to use her own toilet during her working hours rather than subject herself to that embarrassment.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Isn't that terrible?
Well, I've often returned home instead of using some public facility somewhere just because I don't trust them, you know what I mean, or whatever. And I mean, I sometimes go into 5-star hotels in London and order a drink just because I want to use a bathroom, because I'm not going to use it in the pub I'm going into next door. You know what I mean?
Where's your favourite public loo, or sort of loo in a hotel or a bar or somewhere in London? Because we all have our favourite toilet.
Do we?
Yes, we do.
I'm not sure I have. Any 5-star hotel will do me. And I just walk into the cocktail bar, order a cocktail, and I avail myself of the loos because they're always lovely and clean. And you know, a lot of pub, even these days, a lot of pub bathrooms are pretty dodgy. But anyway, look, that's not a subject that we...
Well, I tell you where I really like, and if ever you're up that way, yeah. In fact, we should go there for a drink. The Ham Yard Hotel in Soho, very, very nice Swiss hotel.
Really?
It has the best toilets in London. I'm not joking.
Well,
I could spend half a day in there.
Goodness gracious me, Miss Jones. I don't know. We find out new things about you every day.
Have you ever had relations in a public toilet?
No. I haven't actually. I've, you know, blokes have boasted to me over the years. In fact, you remember the wine press as well as I do. And a senior Fleet Street journalist told me once that he was on the phone in the corridor of the wine press. Do you remember it at the back? You went.
Yeah, very well. I don't remember a corridor though.
Well, you went to the back and you went through the doors.
Yeah, there was a little bit that you went through where the men's and the ladies were.
Exactly, and there was a phone on the wall there. And of course,
that's right. Yes, there was.
In those days, we didn't have mobile phones, so somebody was always on the phone. But this guy told me that he went on the phone to ring the night desk, find out what was going on. And a woman who I know, but he did not identify to me, so you're a suspect here as well, Miss Jones. A woman came through the door from the main bar, squeezed his bollocks, right?
What?
Yes, while he was on
the phone. Outrageous! Family show, Mr. Parry.
family show. And then gave him the eye, and he followed her into the women's loo, and they had sex in the women's loo. He told me that, and I don't believe it. I think it was a boast. It can't possibly have happened. Somebody would have noticed. Everybody in the bar would have been aware of it. And the person who made the boast was never that confident with women.
How interesting. Yeah. I remember going into one of my private members clubs, into the ladies.
Yes.
Once, and it was clearly going on in the next cubicle.
Good God.
What do you do? You kind of stand there and freeze and think, It's like hearing it through the wall in a hotel, isn't it? You freeze.
Yeah.
There's that moment when you think, oh, No. Really, one shouldn't be too surprised. No. It is a natural activity, let's say, that all human beings indulge in at some time or another.
Especially when you've
had a few drinks. But it's always a shock when you sort of overhear somebody else doing it.
Yeah. I went into, I was in Stringfellow's once. We used to go and see Peter Stringfellow all the time. He loved
Yeah, he was fun, wasn't he?
Oh, he's great fun. And you were welcome there all the time. Always bowls of champagne on your table and all that kind of stuff. And I went into the men's bathroom and it was loud and obvious sex coming from the last cubicle to the extent where we all thought the wall was going to come down. You know, I'm not joking. I mean, it was so active. But the worst thing was that we knew that the woman concerned in this sexual act was wearing Manolo Blancos, or whatever they're called, because it was sticking out from under the door.
Oh, no. You sure it wasn't him wearing them?
Oh, no. And they had red soles. And are they Manolo
They had a few other red bits as well by the time they came out.
Right, yeah. But anyway, look, this is a family show, Miss Jones. We shouldn't be telling stories like this. So there we are. Right.
Slapped wrists all around.
Absolutely. Right. Okay, folks. That's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed. Miss Jones, thank you as well. And I look forward to being back with you. I'm sure Miss Jones does, this time next week. I worked for an editor once, and I used to run the paper on a Sunday, so I'd ring him sometimes. And this guy, and I'm not going to embarrass him by saying who it is, but he would have the phone on the table at home where he was having his Sunday roast lunch. And he was so arrogant that if anybody rang, he'd just hit the speaker button. And then he would not stop eating. He would talk for maybe 5 or 6 minutes, but continuing to eat, continuing to shovel roast beef and potatoes into his mouth while talking to you. It was disgusting. And I used to just cut the phone off. I just used to cut it off. This guy told me that he went on the phone to ring the night desk, find out what was going on. And a woman who I know, but he did not identify to me, so you're a suspect here as well, Miss Jones. A woman came through the door from the main bar, squeezed his bollocks, right?
What?
Yes, while he was on
outrageous.
The phone.
Outrageous! Family show, Mr. Parry.
family show. And then gave him the eye, and he followed her into the women's loo, and they had sex in the women's loo. He told me that's
no.
And I don't believe it. I think it was a boast. It can't possibly have happened.
Where's your favourite public loo? Or sort of loo in a hotel or a bar or somewhere in London? Because we all have our favourite toilet.